I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
Welcome to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Today in studio, we have Gabriel and Gina Stoneman, renowned restaurateurs of so many places. Joseph Leonard, Jeffrey's Grocery, Fedora, all located in Manhattan. If you don't know Gabriel, didn't read that wonderful, glowing piece about how you created Little Wisco here in New York in the New York Times. Here's your chance to meet him and understand where he came from. We were just emailing prior a little bit about your history, your past, and I didn't know that you grew up in a Sephardic, you know, very religious family. Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in Northern Virginia. It's an area called Fairfax Station. It's just outside of D.C. And yes, my mother's from Morocco, and my father's from Baltimore. Both Jewish. My father's Ashkenaz, my mother's Sephardic, but I guess in the realm of tradition and upbringing, we leaned much more towards my mother's customs and traditions at the house. And yeah, I grew up in a very religiously observant home. I grew up keeping kosher.
Can you explain kosher for a sec for those that don't know?
Sure. Kosher, the Hebrew word that you will see in the Old Testament, it's called kashrut. Basically, what it is it's a whole list of dietary restrictions. So many of these dietary restrictions were initially grounded in cleanliness and ways in which to help prevent spread of, not so much... illness, right?
Yeah, you know, like trigonosis in the desert.
Right, yeah. There were many things that you could find in a lot of the forbidden foods that were more likely to make you sick and bacteria 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
I think the main foundation of a lot of these dietary restrictions, though, is based upon an ideology and a belief of discipline, you know, which is by denying oneself certain elements, one appreciates others that they are allowed to have more. If you never deny yourself anything, I think the basis of that ideology is then you don't appreciate that apple more than you do the bacon. You know, if you do deny yourself certain things, then you might appreciate that which you can have more. And, you know, that could very much come into play. Like, I look at the way my parents are when they go out to a restaurant,
yeah.
Right? And even my restaurants, right? And they look at the menu and, you know, immediately, you know, there is a large percentage of the menu that they can't eat.
Yeah.
And I guess that makes them really that much more excited about that which they can.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I think a lot of people walk into restaurants nowadays with the vision of what I can't eat via dietary restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Religious restrictions don't play a part as much because, you know, kosher, go to kosher places. When I was in school in Boston, you know, everyone went to Brookline to the Chinese food places right. Because they couldn't go to Chinatown. But when you're on a plane and they say, pick a meal, you know, there's vegetarian, there's lactose intolerant, but there's kosher. And, you know, it's a glaring omission sometimes to how people operate and cook. And Gina, did you grow up in a similar household?
No, actually, my family is Christian. So we grew up, I mean, they're not very religious at all. So there was really no restrictions. So I was first introduced to all of this when Gabriel and I started dating, and he took me home for Thanksgiving. And, you know, I was washing dishes, and there was separate dishes. There was dishes for meat, dishes for dairy, and it was like the first time that I'd ever actually learned about any of this stuff. Fortunately, his parents, they do keep kosher, but they're not strict kosher. Yeah. So they can go to other restaurants that you know, don't have separate dishes and things like that. But, you know, for us, I actually converted to Judaism before we got married, and you know, we have not made the decision to keep kosher. Obviously, none of our restaurants are kosher. So
I was about to ask if you had like separate dishwashers.
We don't.
In.
No. Yeah. We don't. You
know, it's a slight expense.
It's something that, you know, we talked about. Maybe in the future we'll have a kosher home.
Oh, I thought you were going to say kosher deli, and I was going to jump for joy as well.
No. Although we've gotten a lot of requests.
Yeah.
I actually had a lot of people that have come into the restaurants that know that Gabriel grew up in a kosher home, and they've asked, are you guys going to do that one day?
Yeah.
You should. Apparently there's really not a lot of kosher butchers downtown.
Interesting,
anymore. You know, there's a couple on the Upper West Side, but there's not that many downtown. So
that's fascinating. I kind of want to jump straight from childhood upbringing to college.
Get right into the gut of the mouth.
Wisconsin.
Yes.
That is the gut of the mouth, I guess. Your time in college, sure. UW, that's what it's called affectionately, right?
Yeah, that is what it's called affectionately. I think there are some people that went to University of Washington as well.
In St. Louis, or...?
No, I think the one in Washington State, and I think they refer to their university as UW as well.
Yeah.
So for all the listeners out there, we are referring to UW as in University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Yeah.
Right? And hey, I got a lot of friends that went to University of Washington, so much love to you guys as well. I went to university out there. I got there in 1998. I originally was an out-of-state student. I took what was supposed to be my sophomore year off of school to live and work in the city to become a resident of the state.
Yeah.
So that I could, you know, the main motives were to save on tuition. It's a drastic difference from out-of-state tuition to in-state.
Oh, I know. I went to school in Boston then.
So I spent what was supposed to be my sophomore year doing that. And then I went back to school. And so, you know, I had this fortunate pleasure of living in Wisconsin for 5 years and got a degree in history and political science. But it was while I was there that, you know, like many college students, you need a job to give you some money to live, right? And if you're in school all day, you know, what sort of job can you do at night? Well, you know, I mean, there's custodial services, and then there's the restaurant world.
So politically correct,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I found myself in the restaurant world. You know, I first started off as a line cook. As a line cook, I saw myself working, you know, a certain set amount of hours and in a certain grueling atmosphere for, you know, what was like $8 an hour, right? And while doing that, I saw the waiters working at this diner that I was a line cook at, working less hours and making more money. So I naturally thought I should be a waiter instead.
Yeah.
And so I eventually spoke to the owner of that place, and I got myself a job waiting tables there after some time.
Well, what place in Wisconsin?
This place was called Caffelli.
Yeah.
Right? Right on State Street. And then from there, I went to go on to a couple of higher-end restaurants as a waiter, and as I started working at some higher-end restaurants as a waiter, I naturally saw the bartenders making more money than the waiters. And not only were the bartenders making more money, but, for lack of better, you know, description, there almost seems to be a little bit of like a class system, you know, where the bartender has more respect than the waiter, who has more respect than the busboy, right? You know, being a bartender in a college town carried with it a certain amount of privileges and opportunities that you
didn't still very
get.
PC.
Yeah. This is all code for you get all the girls.
Yeah.
Well, no, you get you do get more attention with the ladies, but you also get more respect from the guests. You know, I see that even today here in New York.
You know,
when you look at the way certain diners will address a server, and then that same diner will get up and walk to the bar, and they're immediately more respectful and polite. And so I noticed, you know, that here's an opportunity to make more money. Also, you know, in college, you know, I started bartending at age 19. This was an opportunity to give all my friends free booze.
Get shift
drinks,
yeah.
It was an opportunity to get all of my friends who were underage like me into the bar, you know, because in Wisconsin, you can bartend at 18.
Yeah.
So it's like, here I am. I'm underage. I've now got all of this premium booze at my fingertips, and I can drink whatever I want because it's not like anybody's going to be checking my ID if I'm working the bar,
yeah.
Right?
I was about to say, do you worry about your employees having this similar mindset?
Well,
we kind of give them free reign.
Yeah. Give them a lot of freedom, you know, because I learned a lot from what I did.
Yeah.
You're going to do it anyway, so you might as well let everybody know, listen, go ahead. We're cool with it as long as you ring it in so we know what you're drinking. And, you know, we're all adults. If you can only drink two drinks and that's your limit, stop at two drinks. Don't get drunk.
I mean, I think Gina hit the nail on the head. What I used to do is I used to give away the house, right? I'd give away so much booze to all my friends. And I would consume considerable amounts. And I had a fun, and college was great. And I made my money, and it provided me the opportunity to travel and do all these wonderful things. I also was, you know, I think my owners were really smart. They did inventory on a regular basis. There's no way that they didn't know I was giving away the house.
I was about to say, are they still open?
I think what it was is I used to host a lot of special nights there. And it was sort of, I have to believe in their mind, this sort of give and take, which is on nights that Gabe's working, he's putting an extra $4,000 or $5,000 into the register because I would throw parties and have my friends DJ and promote the nights that I bartended. And we're making all this more revenue because all of his friends are coming in. Yes, he's probably giving away a bottle of Jack and a bottle of Kettle and a bottle of Jameson throughout the course of the night to his 100 friends that are in here. But without his 100 friends, we're not ringing in a fraction of what we
would. So you were like pre-Groupon.
So, yeah, I was pre-Groupon. So, you know, what we do now at our places and what I've always done is we basically give everybody that works for us carte blanche.
Yeah.
Like, you can give away whatever you want. There is no limit. You can give away booze. You can give away food. You can give it away to your boyfriend, to your girlfriend, to your roommate, to your boss, to your regular. There's one rule. You got to ring it in.
Yeah.
You got to give me an accounting record of what you're giving away. Because if I do an inventory and find, you know, discrepancies between what I know we have in-house and what I have a record for moving out of the house, that's when we have issues and that's when the policy doesn't work anymore.
We also, I mean, we work with very professional people that know when you say, you know, if your boyfriend comes into work and you want to give him something, they know that means, okay, if my boyfriend comes in, I can give him this amazing new tomato tart, but I'm not going to give him the steak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So it's common sense. And we work with a great group of people at each restaurant that know the difference.
They understand, you know, another analogy of the same that Gina just gave is, you know, if somebody comes in and they're having 4 pints of beer, you know, you can pick up one, not charge them for one and pick up 3.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, and fortunately, you know, I'm lucky. We work with so many of my friends from college, and we work with so many of my friends here from New York. We're very fortunate that we have been able to be a part of a team that has a lot of integrity and that treats our establishments like their own. And so they don't want they want to see us have a great night sales wise, and they work towards achieving that.
Yeah.
You know, it's awesome.
So after school, jumping back a little bit, you went and worked in Italy.
I did. I think it's best to represent that what it really was. I didn't go to Italy looking for work. I went to Europe to backpack by myself.
Yeah.
And I started in Eastern Europe and Croatia and, you know, marched my way down that whole coast, you know, through Albania and Bosnia and through Greece. And I was, you know, the total duration of my trip was somewhere around 4.5 months. When I set out, I had no idea how long I was going to be gone or how long my money would last. But I knew I would come home when it felt right. And I guess at a certain point, I wasn't ready to come home, but I was out of money. And so I needed to keep working or find work in order to keep traveling. And at some point, I think, you know, in August, I was in Greece and I was, you know, talking to some other solo travelers, to which they said, you know, it's getting ready to be wine picking season.
Yeah.
Why don't you go find a vineyard and, you know, you can make some money. And fortunately enough, you know, I found a vineyard in Tuscany who took me in for about 3 weeks.
That's
and
not too shabby.
They, you know, they put me up in a villa. I mean, it was, I think, you know, I mean, looking back, I must have had a horseshoe, you know, on my person to get as lucky of a situation as I did, because the vineyard, I knocked on about 5 vineyards doors and got rejected by all of them because I'd gotten there a week late, I'd gotten there a week too early, or they weren't comfortable hiring me because I was illegal. And then finally, I found a vineyard that also had a agriturismo operation. So they had about 5 villas on their property where people would come for vacation. And I mean, we're talking pristine, decked out villas, ivy on the walls, you know, beautiful linens, you know, cable TV, all that stuff. And I found one where there was a German family who had rented out the property for a month, but had to cancel last minute. And the vineyard was still kept all the money. So they had a paid for villa with nobody staying in it when I came looking for a job. And I had a tent and I was like, I'll go sleep in the woods. It's cool. Just let me use a bathroom every now and then. And they said, you know what?
Why don't you have the villa?
Just take the villa.
Yeah.
And so I got to stay in this villa. And I mean, it couldn't have worked out better for me. I think they paid me, you know, we're talking 2003 here, September. They paid me something awesome, like 12 or 13 euros an hour.
Whew.
While I was, you know, working. 2003 was the heat wave summer. You know, it was when there was the blackout in New York that I read about, you know, on newspapers. And I mean, I'm working a straight up 8-hour day, making my euros all under the table, you know, would go into the town and, you know, met the local baker and the local butcher and had my salami and my bread and my cheese and
back home to the cable TV.
You know, it wasn't that rough of a life, you know. I mean, it was definitely laborious hours, and I'm not going to front on that. But, you know, I mean, it worked out.
Yeah. On that note, we're going to take a quick break and come back to see why you ever moved back to the States.
Right.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.
Is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past every Thursday at 12 p.m. as she indulges her curiosities about food, cooking, drinking, and dining of the past by taking a journey through culinary history. Linda interviews authors, scholars, friends, and chroniclers to learn about what was eaten, where, and how, from as long ago as ancient Mesopotamia and Rome, right up to the grazing tables and deli counters of today. The show underscores food as a lively link between present and past cultures. Again, that's Thursday at 12 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, sitting here with Gabriel and Gina Stolman, and still trying to figure out why Gabriel ever left his posh little, you know, villa in Tuscany.
Yes.
There's a reason.
Yeah, I mean, the short and obvious, or perhaps not so obvious reason is... The harvest ended.
Yeah.
And
that was your chance to say, because I had to go find Gina.
I was waiting. Yeah. I was waiting. Yeah. It never happened.
Yeah.
The harvest season ended. And I also didn't, you know, at the time, I didn't want to keep doing that. That was a means to an end.
Yeah.
I was there to get enough euros to try to keep going for another month and change.
Yeah.
And... mission accomplished. You know, I went from there to an airport, you know, within a few days and
back to the NYC.
Flew to Spain.
Oh, excellent.
And you know, did that until money ran out a second time.
Yeah.
And then back to NYC, yeah, with, you know, like $50 to my name.
Then you had to find another bartending job.
Yeah, I had to find, unfortunately, nobody wanted to hire me to be a bartender. So.
Yeah.
My first job in New York City ended up being coat check.
Whereabouts?
A now defunct club called Dorsia.
Yeah.
But, you know, note to everybody out there listening, coat check in the winter of New York City at a club
rocks.
Pays well.
Yeah. I've had friends that have been coat checks in like five, you know, four-star New York restaurants.
Pays, yeah.
It pays,
especially nightclubs.
I don't know about four-star. I was at a nightclub.
Yeah. And
those people are drunk, so on their way out, they just want their coat, so they'll give you five, they'll give you a 10.
Down and dirty.
Yeah.
And, I mean, nightclubs, places that can, you know, cycle in 500 people in a night, and... typically, as Gina mentioned, you know, people are wasted. So when they lose their ticket, you know, and you're sitting there, they're sitting there at your mercy, saying, "I'm so sorry, I lost my ticket. It's the black leather coat." And I'm like, "Really? The black leather coat? You know how many black leather coats are in this closet?"
Yeah.
You know, and then
you should just have like a tissue box of black leather coats.
And then they'll sit there and they'll be like, "Man, come on, I'll give you $20. Just find my coat."
Yeah.
Okay.
And you're like, done.
I can do that.
I can find your coat for $20 because...
whereas you're wearing like this cool black leather coat. You're like, I don't know where I got this one, but it's beautiful.
So, yeah, coat check worked out.
Coat check worked out to the point where...
temporarily.
Yeah, temporarily. But then in 2003, you moved back, helped open up In Vino Pace's wine bar.
No. In Vino's not Pace.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I came back after doing coat check. I came back. I tried to get a bartending job.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's no place in the world other than New York, according to many New York operators, that has, you know, a busy place and values. You know, apparently New York's the only place that can do that, because the amount of answers that I got, you don't have New York experience. You don't have New York.
Yeah.
Nobody would hire me to be a bartender, even though I'd been doing it for 5 years previous. So I ended up getting a coat check job. But anyways, after the coat check job, I ended up working at a wine bar called In Vino.
Gotcha.
Not related to Pace. I worked there for a little bit. Then I ended up bartending at Hearth with Paul Greco and Marco Canora. And then from there, I ended up bartending at Pace. And Pace, I helped open. And Pace was short-lived. I think it was only open about 13 months.
But that was with Joey Campanero.
That was where I met Joey Campanero.
Thusly into Little Owl.
Exactly.
Then the Market Table. And then the Stolman Empire.
Exactly. Yeah, so, I mean, I from when Pace closed, I had the opportunity. I was 25. It was, you know, do I go look for another bartending job, or I locked myself in my apartment and tried to write a business plan. And I was successful, raised some money, built a little out, built Market Table, decided I wanted to go my own direction from my partners, and took some time off and... came back strong with Gina by my side.
Yeah.
And we opened up Joseph Leonard
And I wanted to interject there, because I think I actually met Gina separate of you. I met Gabriel when you were working in front of the house, Maitre D' at Little Owl, and met Gina when she was at the Norwood Club.
That's right.
And prior to Norwood Club, which is a cool little arts-based community slash restaurant slash club.
Mm-hmm. Slash where we got married.
Yes, we had our way. Yes.
Touchdown.
Yeah. Prior to that, had you been in restaurants your whole life?
Well, not my whole life, but yeah.
Well, as a baby, you know, chopping up.
It was my first job when I was 16, and then when I moved to New York, I studied dance and theater, and you know, naturally work in restaurants. But quickly fell in love with, I worked at the Hudson Hotel actually when it first opened in 2000. And I got a job working in the bar there, and loved being in a hotel, loved, you know, all the different departments and everything, all the people it takes to make run a hotel. I was fascinated by the whole thing. So I kind of worked my way into the special events department, and ended up working for Ian Schrager Hotels for a few years as an events director. From there, I started working for Steven Starr, and I was the director of events at Budokan and Morimoto. And then I went to Norwood and helped open the club and was there for a couple of years. And then Gabriel and I decided to start working together. So we've been doing that for almost 2 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank God. Because otherwise, we wouldn't be as successful.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating, though, is that you come from a world of special events.
Mm-hmm.
And not to blow smoke up both your asses, but every time you go to Joseph Leonard or Jeffrey's Grocery, and I've yet to be to Fedora, but I'm going soon, it always feels like a special event. Oh. It's
oh. Thank you.
It's not just, you know, as has been described, a neighborhood joint. It feels like that neighborhood joint that always not just feels like home, but feels like you are a local celebrity.
Well, I will definitely give Gabriel all the credit for that. He's an amazing host. And, you know, one of the things that he did before opening even the Little Owl, and something that he continued, well, we haven't done so much in the last year because we've been busy, is he's a great host. And when he hosts a dinner party, it's like, that's the way he treats his restaurants, you know, like,
yeah.
Like, it's almost like all these people that have never been to the restaurant are his closest friends, and he's inviting them into his living room for dinner. And that's kind of the philosophy that we run the restaurants by.
Well,
in the Times
piece, actually, there was a, you know, a line that I pulled out in which you said that you learned while in Wisconsin to treat every guest as a regular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, that's what it feels like. Cheers. I mean, not to use that illusion, but I went into Joseph Leonard one time and I got slow clapped on the walk in, I believe.
A slow clap is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a lot of slow clappers that are working behind the bar and our managers, and it just makes everybody feel great.
Yeah.
And it's genuine.
Yeah. Definitely.
We're really happy that you're there.
Yeah.
That you know, there's a saying that says, you know, treat your locals like celebrities and your celebrities like locals. I think we really, really try to exercise and embody that. And, you know, I think something that is really important to what we aim to try to do is to create regulars. You know, that is our goal with everybody that walks through the door. If this is your first time here, what does it take from us to try to make you a regular? And if you are a regular, what do we need to keep doing to keep you that way? And, you know, that bottled with genuine, you know, gratefulness. And let's be honest, there's a lot of options of places to go eat at.
Yeah.
And if we don't show appreciation and gratitude for you walking in into our door and into our home, then I think, you know, we're off.
Well, I'm glad you actually used the word home, because I don't think it's a farce that you named Joseph Leonard after your grandparents, that the place feels familiar, feels, you know, like family.
Right.
So it does feel like walking into somebody else's home rather than a restaurant most of the time. And
that's the greatest thing I can hear.
Yeah.
So thank you. You know, I mean, that's definitely something we're trying to do there, is make it feel warm.
And, you know, Jeffrey's Grocery.
Named after my father.
Named after your father. So, I mean, these are great allegories, but they're truthful. You know,
And there's a lot of thought that goes into the way we design each restaurant. And, you know, if you go to Jeffrey's right now, above the bar, you'll see an old train set, which belonged to his dad when he was a kid. And there's just a lot of things that they're special that we try to incorporate into each restaurant.
Yeah. So, I mean, aside from the similarities that you own all three and operate all three, what are the most distinct differences between Joseph Leonard, Jeffrey's Grocery, and Fedora?
Sure. I think the most distinct differences are in the food.
Yeah.
By and large. You know, when I look at Joseph Leonard, I what I see and what I hope other people see is what we set out to do, which is create an American bistro, right? You know, we have some very, you know, apparent odes to a traditional French bistro. You know, we have Jim McDuffie, our chef's beautiful pâté and rillette, and, you know, we sometimes put bœuf bourguignon on the menu, or we have a steak au poivre, or we have mussels and fries, you know, and then all of that's married with all of these, you know, unique individual creations based upon, you know, what local ingredients we can find vegetable and fruit wise, and what proteins, meat and fish that our purveyors are bringing to us. You know, then I look at Jeffrey's Grocery, and Jeffrey's Grocery's name implies a lot of what we've set out to do there. It's an oyster bar.
Yeah.
You know, it is an oyster bar, but it is so much more than just the raw bar portion.
Are oysters kosher?
Come on now. Unfortunately, they are one of the forbidden foods.
Yes. You denied yourself of them for too long.
I did deny myself of them for too long.
We actually denied ourselves of them at our wedding.
Yes.
You know, it was a rough thing.
We denied
thing
ourselves
to do,
a lot of things that,
that was okay.
I normally eat at our
it
wedding.
It was a great day. It doesn't matter.
Yes. You know, so Jeffrey's Grocery, what we focus on trying to achieve there is a huge raw bar selection that we try our best to present in an abundant manner and in a more value-driven manner than some of the other places that offer similar fare in the city. Then what we try to do accompanying that is we try our best to sort of not allow ourselves to be contained by any other boundaries. And we're only electric there, right? You know, it's only you know, a convection oven, couple of induction burners, an electric cheese melter, and a panini press. And I think it's really astounding what Eric Milley, the chef over there, you know, is pulling off. And, you know, we're right now in a constantly evolutionary process of coming up with new ideas and trying to find out how far we can achieve and push the envelope with those ingredients that we have.
Yeah.
And the equipment that we have to use at our disposal. Then lastly, I think the third place, Fedora, where that differentiates the most is that's got to be probably, I would say, you know, the most out there of some of our dishes, right? You know, when you go to Fedora, what you're going to find more prominent on that menu than you will find on either Jeffrey's or Joseph Leonard's menu is you're going to find offal.
Yep.
And you're going to find offal, which is a testament to the chef, Mehdi. Mehdi, who Gene and I met on our travels to Montreal, who used to be the chef de cuisine at Au Pied de Cochon, you know, has a lot of skill and talent and abilities in taking these otherwise offcuts that are sometimes challenging to make beautiful and making miraculous dishes out of them. I mean, we have this dish, egg in a hole with a tripe ragu, which is
amazing.
Oh, I will. Yeah.
It's out of this world, you know? And I mean, he pairs octopus with sweetbreads.
I did read that.
We have a crispy pig's head croquettes. You know, we have so many cool, funky things.
Yeah.
And then he marries that with this beautiful love that he has for seafood and his devotion to constantly using the freshest ingredients that he can find. And you are going to always find crudo and, almost sashimi presentations through his very, you know, tricked out imaginative mind.
Yeah.
You know, where we'll do, you know, cured Spanish mackerel with crushed homemade barbecue chips, you know, and you're like, that's really beautiful, clean, awesome, delightful fish. And then, you know, you put crushed homemade barbecue chips. Who does that? You know, it's awesome.
And avocado.
Right. And, right.
Well, you know what I think's lovely? I've heard Fedora described as, you know, this historic thing reintroduced.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's wrong in saying reintroduced. It's really reinvented, mm-hmm. you know, from hearing how Mehdi goes about interpreting the menu.
That was really, I'm glad you touched base on that. That's something that was really important to us to do, to reinvent it, and something that was challenging as well because of so many of the neighborhood stalwarts who, you know, you get a lot of this opinionated out outspoken individuals who sit there and say,
wait, where?
Oh,
in New York?
Right.
Really? In the restaurant industry?
Who sit there and they say, oh, you know, you got to restore Fedora and you need to keep it the same. And, you know, Fedora was beautiful the way it was. And these are all people who never went there. Right? And it's like, look, you speak to Fedora and you speak to Fedora's family, and they'll tell you the last 10 years, it was on a downturn.
Yeah.
Right? You know, you speak to them, and look, it is a piece of history, and it is a beautiful heritage and a wonderful family, and we're so grateful we get along well with them. And Fedora lives upstairs, and she loves what we've done with the space. She was in there last week to celebrate her 90th birthday, right? But I knew for a fact if we tried to keep Fedora alive, we would open ourselves up to so much ridicule and criticism saying, it's not the same, it's not as good as it used to be, or this or that. So you know what? We're not going to try to keep Fedora going. We are going to build our own restaurant there, and that's exactly what the Dorado family wanted us to. We're going to make this our own. We're going to keep the name because it's a beautiful name and it's a piece of history and heritage, and we're going to keep the location, and we're going to keep the general layout. You know, I mean, kitchen's still in the back, the bathrooms are still where the bathrooms are, and the bar's up front. Yeah, it's three times as long, and there's a banquette, and there used to not be a banquette, but, you know, it's still a shotgun-style restaurant.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you walk in, it's still called Fedora, and it's still in the space where Fedora's been since 1952, and if we're lucky, we'll have the privilege and the opportunity to keep it running for a fraction of the history that it's already enjoyed. But we're not trying to run Fedora the way it was. We're making it our own.
Yeah, well, I see it as, you know, you preserved its integrity.
Mm-hmm.
But on top of that, you've preserved its tradition.
Absolutely.
And I mean,
it's still a family-run restaurant.
But I mean, this is even recalling your upbringing. Yeah. There is instilled tradition throughout all of your restaurants, mm-hmm. be them newly opened or, you know, something that you guys have pondered for a long time. It shows. And it's not just, you know, a flash in the pan kind of thing.
It's great to hear that.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, I mean, we do put a lot of thought and time and heart into what we do. So it's always wonderful to hear compliments.
Yeah. And where do you see yourselves kind of pitted up against some of the other lauded New York restaurateurs, Keith McNally, Mary Batali? Do you feel like you're going towards...
I don't think I deserve to be in the same sentence as those individuals.
Oh, don't worry. They were actually semicolons when I was saying it. Yeah.
Right.
We're big fans, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're big, big fans.
Yeah.
I think Keith McNally, I've gone on record saying several times, is my favorite restaurateur in New York, in this country, in this world. I think what he's achieved is remarkable, and I love the spaces he's built. They inspire me, actually. I think Mario Batali is one hell of a chef, and I have enjoyed so many amazing meals at so many of his establishments. It's not even, you know, worth rattling off. I think if we are fortunate enough to achieve a fraction of the success that those two individuals have achieved as restaurateurs, I will consider ourselves to be remarkably and through the roof successful, and I will be very, very grateful at what we've accomplished if we do a fraction. That being said, we're going to have to really dig our heels in and work a hell of a lot harder to be included in the category of, you know, just the mega stalwarts that those two guys are.
I can see it. I can see it happening.
Well, I think we got a long, long, long ways to go.
Yeah, we got nothing but time. I just wanted to remind everyone out there, don't just visit the restaurants. Come into the homes of Gabriel and Gina Stillman.
Please do. We'll welcome you with a slow clap.
It's true. It happened. I blushed. It was great. It was fantastic.
It usually starts a slow clap, and then it builds, and then for some reason everybody else in the restaurant joins in.
Oh, yeah.
And it's embarrassing, but delightful.
It's the closest you'll ever be into an 80s movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty special.
Yeah, it's Joseph Leonard, Jeffrey's Grocery, Fedora.
Michael Harlan Turkell.
That's how the slow clap started.
Yeah.
Gabriel and Gina, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Thanks for joining in. Hoping to have you listening Tuesday, 3 p.m. Shout out to Jack Inslee, our executive producer. Peace.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network.
You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great-tasting, high-quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.